contact with you much sooner. During this period since you first contacted me, I have completed my studies at the Army War College, finished my master's degree, which included 6 weeks of internship, settled into a new home, and reported into a new duty assignment. The only excuse that I can give to you that is I've probably been busier than a one-armed paper hanger. But be that as it may, let me try to make it up to you by trying to answer all of your questions as best I can. Now, the mission of the NET team, which was your first question, as it was originally designed, was to introduce the AH-1G into the Army inventory. Now, by various regulations and the mission of the commodity developer, which was AVCOM, and probably by the assumption of a number of prerogatives that were not specifically spelled out, we attempted to do that basic mission, the introduction of the AH-1G. Now, I'm going to cut out and reproduce for you two articles that I wrote, one in the July 31st edition, 1967, of Army Aviation Magazine, and another article in the 11 October 67 edition of that same magazine, which deal in detail with what the regulations were, what the mission of the introductory effort was, and generally how we went about it. It gets into training devices, some of the things we did, and so forth. Recognize that these were written while the team was forming up, while we were getting ready to accomplish the mission, and about the time we were ready to go. To specifically answer your questions in your second letter, we did train ground personnel, airframe, SAS repair, other avionics, the weapons systems, and so forth. We also had special training program on the L-13 engine, which had been introduced a short time before, but which we carried forth as part of the AH-1G effort. People were sent to us initially by the units that were to initially receive the AH-1G and the maintenance units that were to maintain and help support these units. Later on in the program, newbies, people coming into the country, maybe not already assigned, and people reporting into units that already had aircraft were also sent. In answering your question on pure flight training or trying to crank it into combat missions, obviously, since we were doing a good deal of our training out of Benoit and in the War Zone D area and so forth, the occasion to try to pump in actual conditions as much as possible was a big desire of ours. We set out initially to have prerequisites for the people going through the course as being qualified in the UH-1 aircraft with a good deal of gunship time, if at all possible. So that as we initially started the flight training programs, we stayed pretty close to home, and we had some areas designated that were considered quite safe areas that we did our initial work in until people got familiar with the flight characteristics of the aircraft and could handle it pretty well. As far as a deliberate attempt to get involved in a combat mission, no, I can't say that we did that, but quite frequently, because of circumstances or calls for help or what have you, with a qualified instructor in the aircraft, we quite frequently did get involved in participating in some valuable mission work. Now, as far as evaluating the AH-1G in combat, team members and myself originally did a good deal of the flight maneuver work and writing up some pilot training programs as we flew in Vietnam, we constantly changed these. So here I'd say you'd have to say that we were in fact evaluating the AH-1G in combat. We adopted new maneuvers. We developed new ones and changed some old ones. Now, in the formal evaluation sense, I guess you'd have to say that we had no direct mission to do this. Although I, at the time, wrote up a 30-day, 60-day, 90-day, and an 180-day evaluation report on the aircraft, its performance, its failures, its shortcomings, and what have you, recognizing that the introduction of any new piece of equipment is going to have problems. A good deal of this evaluation that I wrote up had to do with manufacturing shortcomings or design shortcomings and so forth. 90 to 95% of these were minor, trivial, little things that didn't work out exactly right, wear points and so forth, and really provided no great deal of problem. On the other hand, there were a couple that became relatively serious, which caused some immediate action on the part of the Army and the manufacturer to correct. I'd say for the most part, these were corrected without any great impact on the performance of the aircraft. Now, if we can move on to your second question, how was the aircraft received by the flight and ground crews? Well, I can only say that everybody that I had anything to do with, all my team members and all the people that we trained, the people that we briefed and introduced to, were thoroughly excited and looked with a great deal of hope of what this machine could do for them. Very little skepticism, very little negative thinking as far as introducing another aircraft into the inventory that was going to be a pain in the neck or cause any problems. In the process of the total introductory effort, I was fortunate enough to fly a great number of senior people, division commanders and so forth. And I'd have to say in every instance, the reception was enthusiastic. Obviously, there are some people that wondered, are we introducing it too fast? How good is it going to be? And that time, I think, worked out that in the long run, anybody that says that it was not, in fact, a great benefit to the Army, to the fighting effort at the time, would be wrong. It was a valuable new piece of equipment and gave a capability that we did not have in the past. As far as any hard VC intelligence on the reaction, the only thing that I can say there deals with our area of operations. Generally, within a very short time after our arrival, I have the feeling, and I don't have anything hard to back it up, is that when a Cobra was in the area or detected or what have you, not very much activity went on that was obvious anyway. And I think most of the people that worked with us at that time will verify that. This, of course, brought us into the area of trying to new tactics, low levels, roll-offs, high altitude approaches, and different things that everybody had been experimenting with. But as far as hard intelligence on the reaction, now I have no none available to me that indicated one way or another what their reaction to it was. I wasn't originally sure what your third question had to do with an AH-1G working in a hot environment, whether you meant combat hot or hot temperature. As you point out in your second letter, you're talking about temperature hot, and I'd have to be honest with you and say, yes, it was a problem. When we did some of the original flights down in Texas, we worked in some 90-degree temperatures, up to 95-degree temperatures during the summer of 1967, which gave us a pretty good indication that cockpit heat would be a problem. We did, the team, an awful lot of work in this environmental area for crew comfort and so forth, and were instrumental in some of the developments that Bell got into of a cooling air through the pilot seat and so forth. Extensively wrote up requirements for cockpit air conditioning. As I remember the figures, in a 90 degree outside temperature and sitting on a ramp in Texas at the time, we were recording temperatures up to 105 degrees in the cockpit. Of course, that was sitting static. For the most part, our experience in Vietnam said that for a normal pilot and in a working environment, after 5 hours in the cockpit, in a single stretch of one or two refuelings and so forth, that you were pretty well worn out and usually pretty soaking wet by the time you got out of it. Obviously, it all depended on what the what temperature was and what kind of work you were doing. Going from A to B didn't prove to be any problem, but if you got into a working environment and make a lot of runs and so forth, or in a training environment that we were working in of going through a lot of flight maneuvers, after 5 hours, your crew was pretty well washed out. Later on, some new improvements were made, and this brought it down a little bit. Tinted windshields and so forth, I think, added to it. It caused other problems, but I don't think it was an unbearable situation, although at the time I did a lot of work in trying to encourage the Army come up with an air conditioning system for the aircraft. As far as any other initial difficulties or complaint with aircraft and components, as far as reliability and tactics concerned, sure, there were lots of problems. I don't know how noteworthy some of them are. Most of them we fixed either on site or through a factory rework type of program. We were able to get them installed in a relatively short period of time. We had trouble with the squirrel cage on the aft drive shaft to the aft tail rotor. We had problems with the bubble seal, the rubber compound around the seals, around the pitot tube in the front. We had problems with the fairing covers on the landing gear struts. But as far as major problems, there was a major problem in the blanking out of the tail rotor under certain tailwind conditions in a hover mode. Tactics-wise, no, I don't know that there was any noteworthy difficulties. The more we worked with it, the more we were able to work out the tactics, the maneuvers we used, and the way we flew the aircraft and took advantage of its great capabilities and potentials that we saw in it. As far as the fourth area that you ask about on the weapon systems, as you're probably aware, when we deployed the aircraft, some of the later developments in the turret system with the 40-millimeter grenade launcher and so forth, we didn't have them initially. We deployed with the XM-18 and the rocket pods, the two different versions on that, and the TAT-102. weapon system. There were minor problems with jams in the feed systems of both the XM-18 and the TAT-102, not insurmountable. My personal opinion of the XM-18, other than the limited amount of ammunition that could be carried in the weapon, it was a very effective weapon. I thoroughly enjoyed using it. We had an advantage possibly over some of the other units that got it later in that the weapons repair personnel that I had and my chief of weapons, Captain Pratt, really knew their business. And so I'd say all in all, we had no problem with the TAT-102 or the XM-18. They were very effective as far as we were concerned. What happened later after I left, of course, I got out of the business and was not directly related with it, although I, at Benoit or at Bearcat, there were a couple of Cobras, the unit that I was with sometime later in 1968, and as far as I know, they didn't experience any difficulty, unusual difficulties with the weapon system. As far as your question on the camouflage paint on any net aircraft, as I initially indicated in early on in this tape, maybe we assume some prerogatives or that were not specifically spelled out. We looked at ourselves as a total introductory crew, not only from the training aspect. As I mentioned, I wrote a number of evaluation reports, not only on the performance of the aircraft, but the tactics used and so forth, how the weapon system was effective or not. In carrying out this, what I saw as our job, we made arrangements after arrival in Vietnam to have an aircraft camouflage painted. The designs were drawn up of what the what we thought was a good camouflage paint job, and it was accomplished. I'd have to be honest and say that it was not always accepted in all by all people that we had a prerogative of doing something like that. Nevertheless, we did do it. I personally feel that it was an effective system, that and especially in an environment like Vietnam with heavy vegetation, a lot of sand, a lot of browns and blue skies and so forth, why it was an effective bit. As to why we didn't carry out and do more of it, I don't know. I was not in a position to make a decision on that. I think it's good. I think the Army ought to look more at it. It's obviously very expensive. It adds to the cost. Other people, probably much more qualified than myself, have looked into this in depth, and whether the weight penalties of added paint, whether the actual tactical advantage gained from it are worthwhile, I don't know. My personal feeling is that it is good, that we ought to do more of it, and that if someone can prove to me that it's not worthwhile, then maybe I'd back off, but I kind of think it was a good idea. We didn't pursue it any further. As I say, we were kind of experimenting to see. We only did one or two ships, as I remember it. The picture you sent me in the in your last letter here just the other day was, in fact, a Cobra that belonged to the AH-1G net. The pilot climbing into the cockpit was Major Jarrett, and the pilot in the front seat was Major Nick Stein, and the crew chief standing there, who's currently a warrant officer stationed at Fort Eustis, was a net team member. I may have a picture, a little better one than you have there, a color photo that I'll try to look up and see if I can find it for you and send you a copy of that. But camouflage paint overall. We did it as an experimental thing to see how it worked out, whether there are great advantages. We reported on it and why nothing was done more with it, certainly beyond my knowledge and beyond my position of knowing why it was or was not accepted. Now, I'm not sure just exactly when you were in Vietnam and where you heard of the 5th Aviation Detachment at Vung Tau referred to as the Cobra Net Team. The team that I originally put together in 1967 from the April to August time frame, which I was with in Vietnam from August to January of 1968, and that continued to function at Benoit until the summer of 1968, when most of the team returned to CONUS and so forth, or had been transferred to other places, was the original net team. Now, at about that time, sometime in the fall of 68, the equipment, the training aids, and so forth, and the basic mission for training in country was transferred to Vung Tau, to the I don't remember what they called it, the AMTAP. It was a takeoff on an AMTAP, an ABSCOM-sponsored training mission. The introductory effort had been completed. The system had been introduced into the Army. It had been introduced into the training system of the Army. Students were coming out of Rucker, out of Southeast Signal, out of the Ordnance School, Transportation School, qualified and were routinely being shipped to Vietnam. The aircraft had been introduced into the units going to be first receiving it in Vietnam. Therefore, I say that the whatever this detachment was at Vung Tau was primarily carrying on that honing up mission or giving an added capability of a training effort in country, not truly a net mission or an introductory type of training mission. They did get the equipment that we used and carried on the mission after that was officially terminated. Since I left the team after the first of the year in 1968, went up to the 1st Aviation Brigade and then later to the 214th Battalion at Bearcat in the summer of 68, fall of 68, about the time I left in October of 68, I know that the mission had been transferred, but as far as a date of final termination of the net mission, I just don't know when it was. If I was pinned to the wall on a date, my original program called for a one-year introductory effort and new equipment training program. This is rather a normal period of time, or when I was working in that business, we figured that if you couldn't introduce it in a year, why you weren't doing the job. So I had originally figured that the effort would conclude itself in August or September of 1968 and thereafter be taken over by the normal schools program and so forth. Now, I guess that in general ought to cover the basic six questions you ask and give you a little bit on the camouflage picture that you sent me. Let me wander just a little bit and some other background information. As I indicated, I'm going to go through a stack of photographs that I have, and I've got quite a few of them, and I'll go ahead and try to send you some. I'll indicate on them whether I desire to get them back. Many I will be able to give you a copy without asking you to send it back, but in the formation of the new equipment training effort on the AH-1G, I look at it maybe selfishly or self-centeredly as kind of a milestone in the way we did things in the Army during Vietnam, before or since. It was a good program. It was a well-thought-out program. It was conceived when a program like this should have been conceived. prior to my getting involved directly in it, I had been assigned to the transportation school at Fort Eustis and the component repair and training of aircraft mechanics. I happened to be fortunate enough to be present at Fort Worth and in AFSCOM when the first contracts were signed on going into an effort to develop the AH-1G. As a result of some of those early meetings, I gained a great deal of enthusiasm myself to get involved with this program and was fortunate enough to be selected in July, August 1966 to move out to St. Louis to form up the introductory effort in conjunction with AFCOM, with the project manager from AMC and the DA staff. In this effort, I was stationed in the St. Louis for about 8 months, and during this period of time, we developed the introductory letter, the material that would serve as the introductory vehicle, selected people, and this I can't emphasize too strongly. Every member of that team was virtually hand-picked by name, and I actively sought out the best talent that we could find in each of the areas of expertise that we were looking for. I must say that in this endeavor that I had the utmost cooperation and support from the Department of the Army staff, DESPER, the OPO people. With almost without exception, every individual that I asked for and to get on the team was in fact put on the team. My efforts at the various commodity commands for instructors from Rock Island, for instance, from WECOM, the instructors from the Bell helicopter people, from Lycoming, and so forth, were in fact the best the business had to provide. Failure was just not in their mind. We had the best folks to do a good job, and by God, they did a good job. Very interestingly, the effort initially started off with six officers, six warrant officers, and 12 enlisted people as what was thought would be the involvement of the initial effort. If I remember my numbers right, we ended up with about 56 people, which included a number of, I think it was 13 officers and warrant officers, and about 20-some enlisted personnel, crew members, as well as administrative and supply maintenance types, and a number of military DAC civilians and contract civilians for a total of about 56, if I remember right. One of the pictures I may send you might have a list on that. I'll try to look it up and give you a rundown on that. The effort at the Bell plant after the initial formation period, I got interrupted there. After the initial 8 months of doing all the homework and getting this thing set up, the team finally started to assemble at the Bell Helicopter Plant in Hearst, Euless, Texas, in April of 1967. This, I think, was a very fortuitous move. Our homework had been done. We had all our plans. We knew what we were going to do, and if the production program paid off the way we anticipated, we knew pretty much when we were going to be in Vietnam. We started forming up around the first week in April, and this period for the next 5 months, we ate, lived, and slept the Cobra. We attended classes at the Bell plant that we had originally contracted for and designed, and became expert in each of the areas: pilot training, avionics training, maintenance training, weapon system training. We lived on the production line virtually. A number of us spent a good deal of time at the Globe plant as each ship, number one, number two, and number three, went down the production line. We talked to the designers. We talked to the assembly people on the line. We sat in the cockpit. When we didn't like where a switch was, why we were able to influence them to move the switch. We did a lot of human factoring bit as the initial ships were going down the line. This, to me, it was a fabulous opportunity for the Army to get directly involved in the actual assembly operation, to attempt to influence just how the end item came out. And I'll do everything I can in the future to see to it that any new introductory efforts in vehicles for the Army get this advantage. We established a rapport with the people at Bell Helicopter that proved invaluable in our early months in Vietnam. We knew the people in the parts department. We knew the people on the production line. We knew the design people that were making the changes that we recommended. And therefore, when we did get to Vietnam and we ran into a trouble, why, it was a very simple operation to go through official channels, through St. Louis, and through personal contact with the Bell representatives, and knowing who we were sending a message back to, so that they understood what we were trying to say to them, that we needed to change this or needed to change that. And this worked beautifully. I might indicate that my attitude during this whole thing was that really and truly I had three bosses. I was working officially and assigned to AVCOM in St. Louis. The project manager in Washington and AMC strongly influenced everything that I did. And if I were to say that I was not in some way working for Bell Helicopter, the president of Bell Helicopter, why, I'd be lying, because I did in fact try to ensure that we did get the best product and the best image from the introductory effort on the AH-1G. Now I'm going to put together in a package, an envelope for you. Got interrupted again by a telephone. I'm going to try to put together in a little package for you a few odd and end pictures that I've got, and a couple of articles. I'll send you a book that we put together, and would ask you that please don't lose it or what have you, and please return it to me. It's the last copy I have, but I think you might get an insight out of it of some things. I'll also reproduce some Bell publicity or PR type information that I've got. I've got accumulated, I guess, some 300 or 400 different photographs of all aspects of the whole program, and which I can't send you. But certainly if you get back to the East Coast here and get near the Williamsburg area, I'd certainly wouldn't mind you looking through them if you have the desire. I happen to be looking through one of them here as I was getting this material together, and let me just read you some little pamphlet I put together. I don't have another copy of it, but I'll give you some significant bits that I thought were significant, at least at the time that I put it together. The team assembled on 10 April 1967. We started our factory training program on the 17th of April. The team aircraft, we got off the production line as they came off the production line in August of 1967. We began our deployment to Vietnam in the period 25-28 August, and actually the people part left, as I remembered, on the 27th of August. We were fully established in country on the 4th of September and ready to go, and started the in-country training program on the 18th of September. Now, as I indicated earlier, our effort in-country had two phases. We had an initial effort, the initial introduction of units to first receive the aircraft, and that was to terminate in February. And the secondary effort, or follow-up effort, which I had left the team by then, was to be conducted during the period March to August of 1968. In coming up with numbers, everything I read, I come up with a different number, so I don't remember offhand what we ended up with, but my plan at about the time we deployed had 55 or 56 people, a team chief, 12 pilots, 25 maintenance and administrative enlisted personnel, 7 instructor personnel, which were military and DAC, Department of the Army Civilian, and 10 instructor personnel, contractor furnished type people. Now, I broke the team down of the 13 officers and warranted myself as the chief. I had one platoon leader, IP, a platoon operations officer and IP, a platoon administrative officer, also an IP, a platoon maintenance officer who was an IP, a platoon armament officer who was an IP, and a platoon supply officer who was an IP. Now, in addition to that, we had 6 people totally dedicated to the instructor pilot's role. Although all of us served as instructors, most of us had another duty, but I tried to keep some 6 of the pilots out of any too many extracurricular activities, and they devoted their full time to that effort. In the enlisted area, we had a platoon sergeant, a shop foreman, an assistant platoon sergeant, line chief, rotary wing and tech inspector. We had one. We had one engine repairman, one aircraft electrician, a sheet metal repairman, 6 crew chiefs, 3 helicopter mechanic helpers, 3 aircraft armament repairmen, an avionics mechanic, an avionics flight control equipment repairman, an avionics communication equipment repairman, a tech supply specialist, an operations clerk, and 2 administrative specialists. As far as the DAC instructor team members went, we had an equipment specialist for weapons, an equipment specialist on avionics, and that was 3 each of those, and 1 equipment specialist on fire control. Now, on the contractor furnished team members, we had 4 airframe instructors from Bell Helicopter Company, 1 airframe weapons instructor from Emerson Electric Company, 3 engine instructors from Lycoming, a fuel control instructor from SECO up in Hartford, and a weapons instructor from General Electric. Now, the equipment that we took with us when we went included 6 AH-1G Cobras with weapons, 1 UH-1 aircraft, a composite trainer, and a weapons maintenance trainer. We had 3 separate and distinct weapon systems that we could use as training aids, 3 each of these, TAT-102, XM-28 with a retrofit kit, XM-29, XM-18, XM-134, XM-159, 157, a D-linker shoot aids, and some smoke dispenser training aids. We had 3 sets of SAS components, as far as the airframe and the electronics aspects of it concerned. We had 3 sets of avionics introductory items, and we had some 3 to 4 sets of instructional material, which we included the manuals, the tech notes, the view graphs, charts, films, bench components, and some administrative records and forms and so forth that we would use in the classrooms. Now, the courses of instruction that we actually conducted in country in Vietnam was an airframe familiarization course. This was a quickie 3-day course, as I remember it, to acquaint people with the aircraft, its systems, and what it could do, and primarily designed for people that were involved with employing the aircraft. possibly, say, brigade or battalion operations officers and things like this. We had the pilot aircraft transition course, which included a separate and distinct phase of gunnery training. Airframe maintenance course, first through fourth echelon, including SAS training. An engine maintenance course, first through fourth echelon, including special instruction on the fuel control. We had an avionics electronics maintenance, first through fourth echelon. We had weapons maintenance, first through fourth echelon. And then we had some separate bits as required, just for some selected people, on aircraft electrics, electrical, hydraulic, and sheet metal. Now, the training devices that we procured in this program included two composite trainers, one electrical hydraulic trainer, a flight control trainer, an armament trainer. In the armament area, we had one, two, three, four, five armament trainers for use at different schools. And the armament operational trainer, we had one of those. And then, as I mentioned before, another of many other bench components and aids that we put together. As far as the CONUS net effort, the training devices for use in the CONUS schools and that we took with us, there were 10 of them. Delivery started in June of 67, and they were delivered all on time. The factory training of all our instructors, as I mentioned before, not only ourselves, but for the other schools, started in 17 April 67. The CONARC MOS training base, I considered, was established with qualified people and material in June of 67, and the CONARC schools started their training during the June-August time frame. I guess that's about all that I can give you right now. I do wish I had the opportunity to sit down and talk to you, and maybe we could better answer some of the specific questions you have and maybe fill some of the voids in. As you can tell by this tape, I can probably talk about this for hours and thoroughly enjoy talking about it. I've got so much information that in many cases, I really don't know where to start. If you get the chance and get back to your home in Virginia and get the chance to get over to Williamsburg, my address you have on Allendale Place is right outside of Williamsburg along the Colonial Parkway on the way to Yorktown. My home phone number is area code 804-229-5279. And if you get the opportunity, why, we can leap through some 300 or 400 pictures that I have and probably some other material I have. I'll send by a separate envelope a reproduction of some of the articles that I mentioned and a few pictures in the booklet I said that I'd let you look at, which I definitely would like returned. If I can be of any other help to you, why, I won't guarantee anything, but you sure take the prerogative and at least write to me and let me know, and if I can do it, I'll try to do it, if I can fit it into my schedule. I certainly wish I could do more for you. I consider the COBRA introductory effort probably a highlight of my career in the Army, professionally and personally. And certainly have a great deal of appreciation for anybody that's trying to do an effort to get the history book straight. And if I can help you, I'll sure try. Take care.
The preceding recording contains the recollections of Colonel Paul F. Anderson, United States Army. Colonel Anderson was the project officer and team leader of the AH-1G New Equipment Training Team from 1 August 1966 through January 1968. This recording was made at Williamsburg, Virginia in February 1974 and was made at the specific request of this author as a part of Research Project 7234 of the American Aviation Historical Society. On 27 December 1974, this author conducted a personal interview of Colonel Anderson at his home in Williamsburg, Virginia, in an effort to clarify two points concerning the activities of the AH-1G new equipment training team. The first point considered the date of deployment of the team from Texas to the Republic of Vietnam. Colonel Anderson confirmed from his official Army travel vouchers that the team departed Greater Southwest International Airport in Fort Worth, Texas on 28 August 1967, and all units and all material and personnel were in place at Bien Hoa, Republic of Vietnam by 1300 hours, 30 August. As a footnote to the story of the NET team's deployment, Colonel Anderson also noted that the 1st Air Cavalry Division was originally scheduled to receive the first AH-1Gs, and the NET team was originally intended to base at the 1st Cav Division's base camp at An K. But during the few months just prior to departure, this was changed to Bien Hoa and the 1st Aviation Brigade. The feeling at the time was that there would be a definite parts and supply problem existing, at least for the first few months of operation. It was felt the supply line to An K would be initially not only too long, but also too hazardous for the new equipment. It should be realized that at this particular point in time, the 1st Air Cavalry Division was heavily engaged with Viet Cong as well as North Vietnamese regulars in and around its base camp at An K. The Army felt that basing the initial aircraft at Bien Hoa would provide a very safe base of operations, at least until adequate supply channels could be established. The second point, which this author was seeking to clarify, concerned several photographs which had been uncovered during the course of research for this particular article. These photographs showed one or possibly two AH-1Gs in the Republic of Vietnam carrying a 3 or 4 tone camouflage scheme. A scheme which incidentally was very strikingly similar to the scheme which the United States Air Force began applying to its tactical aircraft in Southeast Asia during 1967. In an earlier portion of this tape, Colonel Anderson noted that he thought one or two aircraft had been painted. At the time of this interview, he confirmed that indeed only one aircraft, had been painted, at least during the time of his command. He further noted that the camouflage idea had been proposed in Washington to the Department of the Army prior to the NET team's departure, but the idea apparently fell on very lukewarm ears, and it was summarily discarded. However, this didn't stop Colonel Anderson. After arrival in Vietnam, one aircraft was chosen to be painted in a camouflage scheme which was designed by NET members. The aircraft was indeed painted in an Air Force paint shop at Bien Hoa. And Colonel Anderson notes that he had intended to paint all six Huey Cobras in this manner. Colonel Anderson further noted that this was, of course, totally unauthorized, and he did indeed get into a bit of trouble over it from higher authorities. But due to the very unfavorable reaction by the high command in Vietnam at the time, these plans were effectively shelved. And thus, it remains, at least to this author, that only one such AH-1G was ever operated in the Republic of Vietnam with a multi-scheme camouflage pattern.